We are very excited this month to be able to offer something that is unique, I believe, in the history of our doing FMU over the last 30 years, and that's a special bonus issue that hits timely right into this topic that you've all been hearing so much about in the media, which is this genomic testing area. We have a world representative expert, Dr. Michael Nova, who I've interviewed, and we thought this was so important, his message about the use of genomic and tabulomic and proteomic testing, that we wanted to bring it to you as a special issue. So you're going to hear Dr. Nova in a recent discussion he and I had as the Chief Medical Officer for Pathway Genomics, an expert diagnostic laboratory doing work in this field, talk about what is going on in this field, what is the FDA regulation, and how does it interface with the 23andMe story, and how does that ultimately filter down into docs providing better information to their patients about personalization. So I hope you'll enjoy this as much as I enjoyed having this discussion with Dr. Nova. Well, here we are once again at that portion of our functional medicine update that I think really sets the tone each month for the news to use and what's really happening at the cornerstone, the front edge of this developing field. And we're so fortunate once again this month. It just seems like fortune has been in our favor here for some time, because this month we've got Dr. Michael Nova, who is the Chief Medical Officer at Pathway Genomics. And what a time to have someone in the field of genomic evaluation, genomic science, this whole omics epic period that we're living through, watching evolve around us, and with the 23andMe situation that just has recently hit the news with the FDA intersection with 23andMe. It seems like this has risen up to the top of controversy and discussion among people within medicine and research and in business. So to have an expert in this field, Dr. Nova, is more than timely and propitious. I think it is absolutely the right time and place. Let me give you a quick introduction to Dr. Nova. I've known him now for a few years, and from the first meeting on, I've been extraordinarily impressed with his background, his insight, his laser view of this emerging field. And he's a guy who has just the perfect background to do this. He is a medical doctor, dermatologist in specialty training, but also has gotten a PhD, where he worked at the Salk Institute in the laboratory of Nobel laureate Roger Gilman, where he studied genetics and proteomics and human growth factors. He brings a broad-based background, both from clinical medicine and also from that of research, to us, and could not be a more appropriate person to represent for us this very complex and sometimes confusing area, which we call omics, which is the genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, and all other omics, which fall within the scheme of things. So let's, if we can, move with that introduction to a discussion with Dr. Nova. Michael, thanks so much for being involved with Functional Medicine Update this month. And what led you in your career into this kind of research path that ultimately had you take on the position as a CMO at Pathway Genomics?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I'm pleased to be here. I think that when I was working in Dr. Gieman's laboratory, he was a pretty famous person. This is how my background started. And at the time, since he was a Nobel Prize winner, we had a lot of venture capitalists and private equity guys coming into the laboratory and just asking Dr. Gieman if he wanted to start a company. And him and I got to talking about that a little bit and ended up doing just that right out of his laboratory. I was the first employee in that company, and then I just kind of got the bug. After that company was sold, I started a couple of other companies. I've gotten more and more involved with this whole idea of personalization of medicine and also technologies, and then ended up helping Jim Plant, who's our CEO and founder of Pathway Genomics, start up this company about 5 years ago. Since my background is in genetics and growth factors and what have you, it was kind of a perfect fit for me. And then we got really involved also in the nutrition area, looking at genetics and nutrition.
Well, since I first had the opportunity to learn more about Pathway Genomics, I've been very impressed with the way that you've defined the landscape of this emerging field. Now, it's kind of complicated to figure out exactly where to place your shovel and start digging your foundation in this industry, because there are so many different ways that this can occur. As we know, personalized medicine often translates to some as meaning evaluating genes that are associated with genetic metabolism diseases of infancy. For other people, it means dealing with cancer chemotherapy and personalized translational medicine as it relates to specific drugs for a specific tumor genotype. And for others, it might have to do with things that are relating to looking at SNPs and uniquenesses in the individual and personalizing lifestyle and nutrition and other factors that lead to compression of morbidity and improved life outcomes. So In the case of Pathway Genomics, how did you guys decide where was going to be your sandbox, your place to play?
Yeah, I think you gave a pretty good summary. As physicians, we always kind of practiced personalized medicine, but we just didn't have a lot of tools to do it. And nowadays, the tools, like the genetic screening your genes and looking at the epigenome and the transcriptome, all these kind of fancy omics tools have become less and less expensive. And so now it's become very cost effective to do that for each individual and use that information, whether it's genetic information or it's information about metabolites, as you mentioned, or it's information about what proteins you're turning on, and put them in the package or a report for the individual. And we do just about all of those technologies in Pathway Genomics. We're not married to one type of technology. We're just very interested in getting very granular about how your body works, whether it's genetics or proteomics or whatever. And then we're very good at building reports around all these technologies and knitting them all together and giving a report back to the physician. We don't sell anything really direct to consumer. We sell through just physician prescription and physician order. And so they expect a very high quality, easy to read, understandable report about all these technologies that you mentioned. And that's kind of our sandbox. Our sandbox is really how to knit all these technologies together, how to make a really great report, and then how to use certain environmental factors like nutrition as a preventative measures or a measure you can actually use as medical nutrition, which is a little bit what's of interest to your audience.
Let's, if we can, just take a little way station here and differentiate the Pathway Genomics approach to that of 23andMe. As we all know, being very prominent in the news, this FDA regulatory letter now that has gone to 23andMe has called into question whether they have adequate science to document their claims and whether they're doing something that would be considered an approved medical device. And so what's your opinion about the 23andMe issue? Because it's more than just 23andMe. It really paints this whole field with some degree of confusion, I think, for the average person who's reading this, even maybe the fairly well-informed person. They probably are confused about what is going on. Is there any useful information? Are we too early in the science? Is this throwing us back 10 years? What's your impression of this situation?
Yeah, you've asked a bunch of loaded questions there. That's actually pretty good. To qualify things to start off, we're kind of friendly, not even real competitors with 23andMe. We like what they've tried to do, which is democratize, if you will, the ability of an individual to get medical data, and it just happens to be genetic data with 23andMe. I think that that's where things are going. I think the average individual should have every bit of a right to go and get a genetic screen if he wants it as a cholesterol test or whatever, and not necessarily have an MD or some higher power as a way station. Maybe for interpretation, you might need that, but an individual should actually have that right to do that. And so we're different than 23andMe because we have our own laboratory. And so we're at this higher bar where we have to meet state and federal criteria. We have a CLIA license, which is a federal license. We have a CAP license, which is from the American College of Pathologists. We have a New York State license just to be able to sell our tests in New York State, which is a very long and rigorous process. And since we are physician order, we have to be very careful about what we put in terms of reports and what we say to the physician and what we tell the physician, basically what the technology means and what he should do about it. So we aren't really necessarily competitors with 23andMe. They have a different way of reporting. They have a different way of getting the information to the user. And since we use more than one type of technology in our company, our reports are extremely reliable in what we can report. And we feel like we give the best possible data back to the physician that you can possibly get. So we don't just screen for SNPs. We do whole genome sequencing. We do next generation sequencing. We do individual gene sequencing. And a lot of times it's a multiplication of different types of technology that we use to actually get the best data to go in the report. So that makes us really kind of a bulked up clinical laboratory that is using the best available technology and peer-reviewed literature to put in our report. So it's really comparing a little bit of apples to oranges compared to what 23andMe and some of these other direct-to-consumer companies are doing. We don't have a dog in this hunt. We think that there's probably a little bit of an overreaction to what 23andMe is doing in terms of some of their marketing. We think that they probably went overboard a little bit on some of the marketing, but that's all wording in a lot of respects. It's not necessarily that they're not putting out a good product or they're not considerate of what the FDA is trying to mitigate with them. So it's a combination of a lot of different issues, plus the fact that the genetics is, in general, a booming technology. The personalized medicine market on this planet is already $280 billion, and a huge chunk of that is around genetics and genetic screening. So there are a lot of potential players in this market that don't necessarily want to be left off the food chain. And if you're giving the test directly to the patient, it tends to cut out certain people in that food chain that might get a little irritated by that.
I think you've hit a very important point there. And I've had a couple of circumstances within the last 2 months, actually, where physicians have told me that they've had inquiries from their medical licensure groups raising questions that they're providing genetic information to patients from gene testing and questioning their accreditation because they're not trained as a geneticist, and therefore they're out of their scope of license by doing interpretation of human gene testing that has been done for their patients. This follows a little bit what I call the Jolie phenomena, this whole thing about people, particularly women, are so concerned about the BRCA1 and BRCA2, and they're going and having these tests done, and then they're rushing to judgment about potential preventative mastectomies as if somehow this was a major groundswell of poor decision-making that's going on, that the government has to protect women against these bad decisions, and doctors don't know how to really interpret genetic information. And so even physicians-assisted genetic testing has been called into question in some cases, which seems to me to be very strongly an overreaction to the status of affairs. But I'm sure you, being much more closer to the street on this, working with doctors, must have a much more informed opinion. What's your thought about this whole situation?
Yeah, you've got a couple of really good points in there. If I can go back and kind of knock them down one at a time, I think that as a clinical laboratory, again, we're at a higher bar in what we have to report to the physician. So it's up to us to tell the physician, basically, if he orders a genetic test, to tell the physician what it means and what you do about the information, and this is how you interpret it. To be fair, there are almost no physicians out there that have any training. I mean, when I was in medical school, we got one class in genetics and one half a semester in nutrition. We got no basic training in it. So how can you expect somebody to understand a 250 phenotype report and what to do about it? So that's where we come into play. We help that. We're very good at providing reports that are very easy to understand, and the physicians know exactly what to do with our reports. That's number one. It's not up to some governing body to come in and tell them, well, you're not trained as a geneticist, you have no right to order a genetics test. To me, that's nonsense. We're not really trained how to use a PSA test either, or a chem panel or whatever, and we order them all the time because the way the reports are laid out is just kind of intuitive. I don't need to be a laboratory scientist to understand what's in a chem panel or a CBC. It's the same thing for genetics. It's up to us as the provider to provide a very good, very reasonable, very inexpensive, and very clear report to the clinician, and that's what we give them. And then there was one other point you made.
The other point was related to how a physician then interfaces with a patient who has received something like a BRCA1/2 report.
Okay, yeah.
And may overreact to that information.
Yeah, I think that on that particular gene, it's a well-known fact that in a particular ethnic group, which is Ashkenazi Jewish, in the United States, if you have a double dose of this BRCA mutation, BRCA1 and BRCA2, you have a much higher risk of getting breast cancer at an earlier age than if you don't. But it doesn't apply necessarily to other Caucasian groups. It really only applies to Ashkenazi. That's one thing that a physician would have to understand about the BRCA test. When they get a BRCA test from our hereditary panel, that's something that they will see that we will point out to them. It doesn't really apply to everybody. I think that it's up to the clinician to decide, along with the patient, that if they do have a double dose of that BRCA gene, is a prophylactic mastectomy, is that the best choice, of course, to go down? That's really a clinician and a patient's decision to make that choice. A lot more BRCA testing goes on in Israel than it does in the United States on a percentage basis, and many more women get prophylactic mastectomies, and there's a lot of issues around that. There are many clinicians that don't feel that prophylactic mastectomy is the way to go. There are other physicians that would do it in a heartbeat. So there is no consensus from the governing bodies on what to do about basically prophylactic mastectomies, whether it's in Israel or in the United States. So it's very much an individual and a clinical decision process that you have to go down in order to make any kind of decision along those lines.
We're now moving into some really exciting and somewhat controversial area, but let's continue on this theme.
Sure.
The fields evolving around these single nucleotide polymorphisms, where we now see there may be 20 to 25,000 human genes in the human genome, but there are several million variations on a theme by these one-letter alterations that we call SNPs. And so people started identifying SNPs that appeared to have some unique relationship to disease prevalence, and these came out of things like GWAS studies, the genome-wide association studies. And the one that stood out, obviously, in nutrition area was the MTHFR, C6F7, and other variants of the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene, which controls folate metabolism. And so people said, here's an example of something that really could have some clinical relevance. But when we look in the broader perspective at SNP analysis, we're often led to some disillusionment because it doesn't appear that, although people have identified with GWAS certain types of SNPs that are associated with disease, that when you really go and look at patient-specific SNP analysis, it's not so clear that a SNP really leads to a disease. It's more related to something about transcriptomics and gene expression patterns. So how do you, as an expert in the field and Pathway Genomics as a company representing that, tie together this hardwired genomic message that's a SNP analysis with the gene expression component that really relates to how these things ultimately appear in the phenotype and make sense of this to the doc who maybe doesn't understand the difference between genomics and transcriptomics?
Yeah, in general, your DNA that you inherit, one copy from your mom, one copy from your dad, is hardwired into each cell in your body, except for red blood cells. There's no DNA in red blood cells. That is a permanent kind of blueprint on the message, basically, that makes you up as a person. As you mentioned, there's about 25,000 genes that this DNA codes for, and these genes can be turned on or turned off in many different fashions to give you the blue eye color or the bitter taste, you know, for broccoli, or thousands of phenotypes that make up you as an individual. It's really how those genes are turned on and off. The area of transcriptomics and epigenetics and all these other omics that are basically technologies that are used after you understand which genes you have, those are the whole turned on, turned off technologies. You're turning your genes on or off. And so as a company, we know that that's very important. You could have the BRCA gene, or you could have the gene for Alzheimer's disease or predilection for Alzheimer's disease, but that doesn't mean it's turned on. That doesn't mean it's not getting shut off by, let's say, a tumor suppressor, so you won't get breast cancer. You don't know that unless you go down the path and try to figure out what proteins and if they're mutated or transcriptome is happening and how the genes are turned on and off. And the environment can play a huge factor in that. For cancer, and cancer doesn't happen overnight. This is a decades-long process of a lot of different mutations, a lot of different types of genes turned on and off, and then in the end, you potentially get a tumor. And it all has to do with this whole lineup of your DNA and then your transcriptome and then your proteins and then something bad happens or something good happens. And so as a company, we communicate that information to the doctor, especially in our cancer products. And our cancer products are very much dependent on epigenetics and doing RNA sequencing, transcriptomics. And so for the doc who doesn't really care what the technology is, he really just wants to know, if I've got this gene, is it potentially turned on? How can I potentially turn it off? What do I do in terms of personalizing the therapy for this patient? And that's kind of where genetics or this whole area is going. It's using all these different technologies and putting them in a fashion basically for the physician so he gets a very clear, concise message at the end that you've got this gene, it's probably turned on. You should probably use this drug because it's a targeted therapy against this particular tumor, and this is the success rate. And if that drug doesn't work, you try this drug, and maybe you add this food with it. It just becomes kind of a big systems problem. And that's what our company's betting on. This is our bet in this company. Medicine is basically a huge systems problem, and we're trying to peel back the onion on what the system is.
Yeah, I think that was beautifully said. Of course, that's the fundamental concept that underlies functional medicine. It was an attempt to try to find a clinical way to apply this emerging understanding of systems biology in healthcare and how the gene-environment interaction actually translates into function. Let me, if I can, go to your point about epigenetics, Michael, because I think this is a really exciting back-to-the-future concept. We know that epigenetics has been around since time immemorial, and certainly it's been understood at some level in developmental biology. We wouldn't be able to produce all this cell differentiation if it was not for epigenetics from the single fertilized ovum that ultimately becomes a multicellular organism. So it's not like Right. It's a brand new concept. But in terms of understanding, say, the methylation of promoter regions of genes that establishes the methylome, that's becoming a new and more important part of our focus. How is pathway genomics, and what's your view on this methylome analysis and how it's going to play a role in our understanding of what gets hardwired into function?
It's not just methyl groups that change how DNA is turned on and off. And when we talk about methyl groups, it's really methylating one type of base pair, which is the cytosine. You just add another kind of carbon to it. There's also phosphorylation. There's methylation of the histone proteins, the kind of yo-yo that the chromatin winds around and the DNA winds around. So there's a number of different spots that individual carbon groups or individual phosphorus groups get attached to, and that will change the structure of the chromosome. And because you're changing the structure, you can turn genes on or turn them off. So methylation has a direct correlation to that. RNA also is a turn-on, turn-off mechanism, especially microRNAs. You get that information from the transcriptome. There are drugs now that are demethylators or methylating agents that are coming down the pike used in cancer chemotherapy to turn genes on and off, to turn either tumor suppressors on, like P53, or oncogenes based on their methylation status. So that's a very, very exciting area, and it gives kind of a whole new way of using this whole epigenetics area for treatment, and that's happening now. There's our FDA-approved drugs like Vidaza that are methylators. They're already approved for cancer chemotherapy, and there's a lot more that are coming down the pike. And very interestingly, in regards to your particular group, a lot of food items like flavones and isoflurane are all methylators or demethylators. They act along those pathways by shutting down the enzymes that are actually responsible for methylation or demethylation. So that's a very exciting topic. Curcumin is a good example of that. I think there's about 60 to 70 clinical trials now on curcumin for hard tumors, pancreatic tumors, and some other things. But it's starting to become a very well-characterized micronutrient. And as you know, every one of these micronutrients has some sort of their active compounds. They bind to certain things. They turn things on and off. And in a lot of respects, in fact, the majority of respects, they're either methylators or demethylating agents.
So when we look at this evolving language, which it seems like the lexicon the doc has to keep up with is changing all the time, and one of the things that we hear more about is exome analysis. Could you tell us a little bit about what is exome analysis and how does that relate to this whole gene expression story that you're describing?
Yeah, if you look at a long strand of DNA and there's 25,000 genes, the 25,000 genes are really the exome. That is the protein coding chunks of your DNA that actually make things. That's called the exome. So when we do exome sequencing, all we're doing is sequencing all of those 25,000 gene areas. For introns, or the end zone, if you want to call it that, the introns, that's the rest of the DNA. That's the dark matter where a lot of the epigenetic function happens. You know, you've got enhancers and de-enhancers and methylators and demethylators, all these kind of really cool epigenetic mechanisms to turn genes on or off. Those are in the intron areas. So the exon area is really just the protein coding areas, the 25,000 genes. So when we do an exome screen, that's what we're looking at.
So now if a person says, I'd like to know a little bit about how the promoter regions of my genes are being activated by their interaction with the environment through these processes you're describing, what kind of questions would they ask from the laboratory to get that information?
Well, there's a couple of ways. There are now chips, methylation chips, on the market from companies like Illumina that look at 450,000, let's say, hot spots that particularly are prone to methylation. So you can run that chip as kind of an epigenetic test if you want. The best way to do any kind of methylation assays, though, is what's called bisulfite sequencing. And that means you basically have to sequence an area and then look at individual base pairs and use bisulfite to figure out which ones are methylated directly. So that's not really a chip. That's using sequencing technology. If you really want to look at all the intron or the promoter areas that are guiding how the genes are turned on and off, the best way to do that is probably with a whole genome sequence and then do bisulfite sequencing on the back end to figure out which ones are methylated and which ones aren't.
Okay, so now let's go from the global, very sophisticated kind of whole enchilada story down to where a doc is saying, oh boy, now it sounds like I'm in a state of overwhelm. I'm not sure exactly what I should do. So how do we take this information down to the street and use this in a way today that would really help patient management and improve outcome?
Yeah, and that's the shoot match right there. We found out very early that if we gave a doc a report that had 500 different diseases in it and 1,500 phenotypes, he wouldn't read it. He wouldn't know what to do with it. He wouldn't read it. So what we did is siloed our reports down to manageable chunks of genes. And then the way we report it to the doctor is that these are the areas that are important. This is why it's important. This is what the genetics is telling us in these areas. And this is what you should do about it. You should eat a low-carb diet. You should have more folate in your diet because you've got these genes. It's very, very manageable chunks around a lot of information. So even with the whole genome sequence, you can go out and get that done now for about $5,000 to $10,000 from Illumina, and we'll help with the report generation. We're one of their report providers. And we will basically just give you the stuff that we think is with the known information, the known published information, we would give you the stuff in that right up front that is of most important and what is relevant to the particular patient. That is really the name of the game. Especially when you're dealing with general practitioners, you know, who are seeing, you know, 20 patients in an hour, they've got 10 minutes to see a patient, they're not going to read a huge report. They're going to read a very concise, very short summary like they're used to getting on a clinical panel from LabCorp, or they're used to getting a CBC from the lab down the street. They want something that's short, concise, and tell me what to do. Doctors aren't illiterate when it comes to genetics. There's just a lot of information that they need to synthesize down in a fashion and couple that with the clinical data on the patient. Is the patient a smoker? Is he overweight? Does he take his medicine? What medicines are he taking? Couple that with all that information and then make decisions with the help of genetics. Genetics is just another tool to help them do that.
So I've been told by people like yourself that are experts in the field that the ultimate lab test is the whole genome analysis, because once that's done and done accurately, that it incorporates every other lab test that ultimately would have to be done and would be developed in some time. That information, once it's encoded and properly put in a database of your specific whole genome analysis, will give rise then over time as our sophistication of interpretation increases and our informatic power is more capable of handling big data, that ultimately we'll have every bit of information we need encoded within that. Is that really where the field is going, or are we too early on to say that the whole genome analysis is really the holy grail?
Yeah, I think from a technology standpoint, once the whole genome sequencing comes down to $1,000 or under, I think you'd be hard-pressed not to do it on a one-time basis for each one of your patients, being a clinician. I think that's a definite yes on that issue. Interpretation is another story, though. That's going to take many years to figure out what it all means. And then, as you know, you've got all this information about your blueprint, but that doesn't mean these genes are turned on. You won't get the fact that you've got anemia from reading your whole genome, that you've got less blood cells floating around by looking at your whole genome sequence. That's not the information you get. You get information on the blueprint, your tendencies, and where your body tends to go with the whole genome sequence. So it's not going to eliminate things like clinical panel or laboratory test for anemia or whatever, you know, the routine laboratory test stuff. It's just going to augment it. And going forward, it'll give you information about maybe what foods you should be eating to prevent things from happening, or stay away from this, or let's turn these genes on because I'm going to go run a marathon next week and I need more power, or I need more endurance, and maybe I should be eating this or doing that. And so it's going to be a very good baseline for everybody going forward. And the great thing about this business is that the more people that get sequenced and the more genetic information we get and the more high-quality clinical information we get, the data just gets better, right? It's not like cold fusion, which turned out to be a boondoggle. The more people that get sequenced, the data gets richer, and everybody benefits.
That really raises, I think, the question that is on the mind of many people, and I've seen it written in the blog sphere over the last few weeks as this 23andMe FDA thing has come to light. There's been this kind of Luddite view, which is, okay, this is really cute, this genetics is really interesting, but what the heck does it really tell us? It sounds to us like it's just eat a few more vegetables, have some fruit, and stay away from junk. I mean, do we really need this? It just sounds like it's just maybe fashion without fact. What's your response?
If you look at where the field is going, and I was just at a meeting in Mexico City a couple of days ago where they had the head of NIH Genomics Center give a talk about genetics, and basically, your last statement is false. I think people expected that whole genome sequence happened 10 years ago, that we were going to cure cancer the next week. You know, that's kind of what people were thinking, and that's so far from the truth. But now we're on the verge, and we already have 12 targeted chemotherapeutic agents that we didn't have 3 or 4 years ago that knock down breast cancer and lung cancer based on your genetics. They're targeting your genes. They are targeting the proteins in your genes. And they're very successful. As a dermatologist, with the BRAF inhibitors, the V6100 BRAF inhibitors that were just FDA approved last year, we hadn't had a good anti-cancer drug for melanoma in 30 years. We're ecstatic about using these really hardcore targeted therapies. That's just one field. That's cancer, prenatal diagnosis for a lot of diseases. I think amniocentesis is probably going away because you'll be able to do prenatal diagnosis for a lot of different diseases without having to do those kind of invasive procedures. For obesity management now, there's a whole group at the NIH that is very seriously looking at individual genes. And we know that obesity is 40 to 60% genetic related. It runs in families, and there are genes that are turned on that we can turn off by personalizing things like diet and the way you should do your exercise. We know that as fact, that genes and diet interact. So there's this whole slew of information that is being put together, and it's coming so fast. I think where people get a little anxiety about it is coming real fast. And who do we trust and who should we listen to? Those are very relevant points. And that's why we go out of our way at our company to make sure that we don't send anything out or give any information back to either the user or the clinician that we don't think is completely validated.
That was a very, very nice response. So let me close with what I think is probably an unanswerable question in the purity of answer, but I think your response will help individuals to understand the complexity of what we're talking about. I want to go to Indian corn for a second as an example. Indian corn, all of us who are familiar with it, is this multicolored corn. I could use other examples of flowers that do this, but let's just stay with Indian corn. And so every ear of corn, which has the same genome as every other ear of corn in that plant that was grown, has a multiple different variegated color pattern of the kernels of corn in that ear of corn. And so you might say, well, how in the heck does that work? I mean, if this is all the same genes that each corn ear has on that plant, how can they possibly be so variegated in their coloration from kernel to kernel? And that has to do with this discovery that was made called Spring Harbor many years ago on jumping genes, right? That genes are not fixed and they move around. And it's like, whoa, just a minute here. I thought they were always in the same place. How do they move around? And so we get into this things like copy number variations and all sorts of other interesting concepts that are beyond just SNPs themselves. How does this get woven into our evolving understanding about genes and our discussion of them with patients?
Yeah, I think those are pretty interesting topics. And you're talking about transposable or transposons that jump around from one area in the genome to another. And a lot of these elements are very relevant in cancer chemotherapy. We know what's happening in cancer, basically. It's a genetic disease, and you increase mutations over a period of time, and then you get all these strange types of mutations or even genes moving around. You get big, chunky mutations, you know, copy number variants. You get insertions and deletions. You get gene fusions. One gene from one part of the genome fuses with another gene and produces a product that is bad and basically increases cell survival and increases immortality, which is what you're doing in cancer cells. So that whole jumping gene and variegated genetics is very relevant to how we're going to treat cancer in the coming years, which is knowing what's happening from that genetic level and then targeting therapies either directly at the particular product or directly at the gene or at the methylation status. Cancer tends to be hypermethylated globally, but hypomethylated in the promoter areas because it shuts off tumor suppressor genes. And so we know all that is happening. So how do you deal with it? Well, it's going to be a combination of therapies. As a good example of this, a lot of times the primary tumor does not look like the metastatic disease from a molecular level. It really looks more like something else. And so you can't treat the metastatic disease with the same chemotherapy that you treat the primary tumor with. You have to treat it with something different, something that's more tailored to that particular therapy. And all those copy number variations and transposable elements get rearranged again when you have metastatic disease. One of the reasons, anyway, that a lot of tumor therapies fail over the long run, because the disease is mutating as it gets more metastatic and grows up in different places. So all that stuff that you just mentioned is very relevant toward cancer chemotherapy, and then also other types of disease processes as well.
So as we close this extraordinary discussion, and we've extended our landscape here in this discussion across a quite a wide field that could spend hours and hours, probably days and days, discussing fully, but
sure.
To kind of summarize this, because I know that you do a lot of discussion with docs about actually how to take complexity and make it simplexity, how to simplify it so it can be used effectively. What would be your message to the doc in the street right now as to about how to start accessing and utilizing successfully these tools to help patient outcome?
One thing that we have noticed, and we do go in and see a lot of docs, is that since, again, a lot of them were not trained, hardcore trained in genetics, they do have an understanding of it and why it's important. They just basically want to be told what it means and what to do about things. And it's not a scary thing. It's a tool. It's a tool just like anything else. Where we've had our greatest success in terms of dealing with our individual clinicians is that we are very clear in that regard. That genetics is just one thing. We don't do genetics in a vacuum. It's just another bit of information that adds to the personalization of patients' therapy. And that's kind of where this whole business is going. It really comes down to personalizing individual therapies, because one size doesn't fit all, really, for anything. Whether you're trying to treat obesity or whether you're trying to cure cancer, one size doesn't fit all. And that's probably my biggest takeaway point for a lot of clinicians, and they're finally starting to realize that.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you so much. I know I've thrown a number of wild cards at you here, and you've handled them very, very well. This is a very complex topic that has all sorts of subtleties and new technologies and new words associated with it, but I think you've really helped us navigate through this complexity in a way that hopefully will give the listeners more of an opportunity to understand how they're going to put their feet first into the field and help their patients understanding how to personalize. I think that this has been a major accomplishment in the last 30 or 40 minutes that you helped guide us through. So I want to thank you so much. And I also want to acknowledge the extraordinary pioneering work that you're doing and that of Pathway Genomics in really accessing this technology in a way that will make a meaningful difference in patients' outcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. And it's, again, my pleasure. And do it again sometime.
I'm with you. Thanks a million. You take care. Well, I hope that you found this discussion with Dr. Nova to be as expansive and hopefully valuable in your evolving education and understanding of this field of genomics as I did. This was certainly a very, very broad series of discussions across wide landscape, but I think if you listen to it a couple of times, you'll pick up some real important tidbits, some news to use, and some tools that will help guide you as to how to employ and keep your antenna open and receiving information in this evolving field. So we thank Dr. Nova for her clean job in handling a wide variety of questions that came from me, sometimes maybe with a little bit of velocity and curve on them, but he handled them beautifully. Thank you all, and thank you, Dr. Nova.